Okay, good morning, everybody. This is Bio 241, and it's May 7th. And we're going to finish up Blood, Heart, and Circulation today. That's chapter 13. Okay, so this is Bio 241. We're going to finish chapter 13 today. Some of you might be interested to know what I might put on the test, your last test. All right, it's not a final exam, it's just a regular old test, but it's the last thing that we'll do in here. Except you might have lab afterwards, okay, because we're going to take it on Thursday. Yeah, so those of you that have lab on Thursday, you got to go to lab, knock that out. I think there'll probably be an extra credit, so it'll be in lab, so it'll be worthwhile for you to go. The chapters that will be on the last test are here, 13, 14, 16, 17, and 20. Okay, 20, I think I'm just going to have one diagram on the exam. And so it's not going to be the whole chapter, but it's going to be the whole chapter of the rest of these things. Okay, so 20 will have some special attention adjusted to it. And also, the next extra credit that I'm going to send you for next week is the modified 14.5. So if you want to start looking at that, that's going to be something out of chapter 14, obviously. Okay. All right, and then your last extra credit will be, I don't have a figure number, but it will be the endocrine profile, the hormonal profile versus time for the ovarian cycle and uterine cycle. So you can find out what figure that is in your book if you want to start looking at that stuff. Okay, so last time we started talking about blood, and we had to know what hematocrit is, and I was just wondering, did anybody do that calculation to find out? Right here. The question is the sample from a man or a woman? I can't remember. And I don't want to take time to do it right now, but what did everybody find?
I found
37.5. Okay, that's nice, because it doesn't overlap with men. Right, so you have a clear choice. All right, maybe I'll double check that sometime or come by during office hours. So make sure you know how to calculate hematocrit. Okay, so maybe that's about as far as we got. Plasma proteins. Oh, well, I tell you what, let's start right here. Remember, blood has got two main components. There's the fluid part that we call plasma, and anything that can dissolve in water is in plasma, and maybe some lipid substances, as long as they have carrier proteins, can dissolve in plasma as well. So here's the list of everything that we find in plasma. Of course, it's mostly water. The second compartment that we find in blood are the formed elements. And formed elements include three things: erythrocytes, leukocytes, and thrombocytes. All right, so you should become familiar with their scientific names and not their common names. Okay, then we talked about hematocrit. I think this is important. We talked about albumin. Okay, albumin is important because it adds osmolality to blood. So it decreases the water concentration of blood. And that's really important because there's a lot of water that diffuses out of a capillary. A lot of water diffuses out of a capillary at the proximal end. And then at the distal end, we would like to resorb all of that water that leaves the circulatory system. And one of the reasons why that can happen is because there is a lot of albumin in blood, and that decreases the water concentration. So water concentration is high in the extracellular space and low inside the blood. So which way is water going to diffuse? If water concentration is high around cells but low in blood because there's so much albumin, which way is water going to move? Yeah, it's going to go down the concentration gradient, and so at the distal end of a capillary, this albumin then allows water to re-enter the cardiovascular system. Okay, so that's why it's there. That comes from the liver, and if somebody has liver damage or cirrhosis, they don't make albumin, what would be the effect of that all over their body? They'll start to swell up. That's right. So there'll be excess water in their tissue spaces. All right, globulins do a couple things. They fight infections if they come from B lymphocytes. Some globulins also carry lipids, because remember, lipids can't dissolve in water. But if they're bound properly to these things that are like detergents, then of course they can be transported in blood. And another important thing is fibrinogen. And fibrinogen, when we analyze this word, can anybody tell me something about this word? I don't know if we talked about nomenclature yet or not in this class, but if you look at this word fibrinogen, there is a suffix attached to it, and that suffix has a lot of meaning. So if you see that suffix on any word, then you pretty much know something about that substance that you're reading about. And I guess we haven't talked about it. So in fibrin, right, we have an ogen. Anytime you see an ogen as a suffix at the end of a word, it means that it is inactive. It's an inactive form, but it's at very high concentration in the body, and it can be converted into an active form very rapidly. So this is a protein, can be converted into an active form very rapidly, usually by some kind of lysis reaction. And that just means then that the active part, which is fibrin, can develop in your body really quickly. Your body doesn't have to build fibrin from the very beginning when you need it. Right, so there's a huge reservoir of fibrinogen which can be converted to fibrin in just a moment's notice, as opposed to going through transcription, translation, finding the right amino acid, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So this is a fast way of making fibrin. Right, so ogen means that it's a precursor to fibrin and it's inactive anytime you see that ogen. And we talked about serum. Serum is the fluid left over when a blood clots, so it is plasma minus clotting factors, right? And so it has all of these other things in it. Okay, formed elements, there are white blood cells, red blood cells, and platelets. And so let's talk about red blood cells first. They have kind of a funny shape. They kind of look like a concave donut, and they have this kind of shape because they can fit through very small blood vessels and they have a very smooth surface. They can also fit like a stack of plates on top of each other, right? So they can orient themselves so they can slip and slide through the circulatory system very easily. They also have this shape because it increases the plasma membrane surface area, right? And what did we say about surface area? Well, how should you think of surface area? Surface area, surface area. Oh, didn't I mention surface area in here? Maybe I didn't. Yeah, I did the what? I did the doorway over there. So anytime you think of, if somebody says surface area, you should think of doorway. And a doorway is what? It is a structure for exchange. So as the surface area increases, what happens to exchange? If the doorway gets bigger and bigger and bigger, what happens to exchange? It increases. It's directly related to each other. So because of this dimpling of a red blood cell, it has a very large surface area, and that means that things can diffuse in and out of a red blood cell very easily. And the thing that diffuses in and out is mostly oxygen. So that is the purpose of erythrocytes. It is packed with a compound that we call hemoglobin, and as a matter of fact, every cell contains about 280 million hemoglobin molecules. That's quite a bit. Okay, and each of those can carry 4 oxygen atoms. All right, so that is millions and millions of, well, that's a billion, that's over a billion oxygen atoms in one red blood cell. Okay, so hemoglobin. So that's the job of the red blood cell. It's packed with hemoglobin. There's no room for many organelles. There's no room for a nucleus. There's no room for mitochondria in a red blood cell. Right, because it's so packed with hemoglobin. And because of that, red blood cells can't repair themselves when they get damaged or when they wear out. So they have a short lifespan because they don't have a nucleus. They can't replace any proteins that are made. So there are about between 2 and 3 million red blood cells that die in your body every second. All right, so that's a lot. So what does your body have to do to make sure that you don't become anemic? What is anemia? When you have an abnormal low red blood cell count, right? So what does your body have to do if about between 2 and 3 million red blood cells die every second? What does your body have to do to make sure you don't become anemic? Yeah, you got to produce that same amount to maintain what? Homeostasis, right? Okay, so you're very busy all the time, even when you're studying for exams, watching TV, sleeping, or whatever. Okay, of that process that we're going to look at in just a second. Okay, the other thing that erythrocytes don't have are mitochondria. But erythrocytes still do have ATP. So what's the job of mitochondria? What did you know about mitochondria? They make ATP, but since a red blood cell doesn't have mitochondria, but has ATP, what biochemical pathway is making ATP for erythrocytes? Yeah, glycolysis. So glycolysis can make a little bit of ATP to maintain some of the living processes of this red blood cell, but of course it's not a muscle cell, it's not a nerve cell, it doesn't need a whole lot of ATP, it's mostly just passively carrying oxygen around. Okay, so that's these cells right here. Leukocytes, on the other hand, don't carry oxygen via hemoglobin. They basically fight infection. They're part of your immune system. And some of these cells are pretty interesting because they're shapeshifters. So the microtubule system inside these cells attach themselves to the cell membrane like most cells. But what is different is that those microtubules can push and pull on the plasma membrane, changing the shape of the cell. So here we have a leukocyte actually changing shape and squishing through a small pore and a capillary. And this motion of the cell moving around by changing its shape is what we call diapedesis. Diapedesis is the motion of these, oh, it says right there, of these white blood cells. Okay, so you have white blood cells hanging out outside your body, for instance, in the spaces of your lung, which is really outside your body, and they're looking for bacteria and viruses and things like that to kill them, but also to drag some of them into the body so that the rest of your immune system learns what they're like, and then the rest of your immune system can even build a better immune system against those pathogens. Okay. So, the most important that I want you to know about are these lymphocytes right here. Lymphocytes make antibodies, which are, we're going to talk about that today, right? But especially antibodies that are attached to pathogens, okay? Not antigens that your body makes. Every cell membrane has antigens on it, which is really kind of a signpost of who you are. That's your signature. Right, these lymphocytes don't attack those antigens, but foreign antigens, antigens on other cells that don't belong in your body. They produce antibodies. Okay, neutrophils, the most common, and these are the first to arrive at a site of infection. So if you have pus at a site of infection, mostly it is neutrophils that are phagocytizing bacteria, for instance. Thrombocytes. Come from a precursor cell that we call a megakaryocyte. It's in bone marrow, and a megakaryocyte just fragments, little cell fragments from itself, and it produces these platelets. And the platelets only live for even shorter than a red blood cell. I forgot to tell you how long a red blood cell lived for. That's what I was trying to remember. 120 days, right? So a red blood cell lives for about 120 days. These platelets only probably about 10 days, so between 5 and 10 days. And they have to be replaced. They're important for preserving blood. We said one of the functions of blood is to prevent blood loss because it's a fluid connective tissue. There has to be a mechanism by which it stops flowing out of your body when there's damage to a blood vessel. Okay, so platelets do this by releasing serotonin. You're kind of familiar with that because we looked at that as a neurotransmitter. Here it is still a signaling compound, but not really a neurotransmitter because it's secreted by these platelets right here. And serotonin then causes vasoconstriction. And we're going to see that when the diameter of a blood vessel decreases, the flow through that vessel decreases dramatically. And I think you did some experiments in lab. Okay, so that's one of the things platelets do. Hematopoiesis is the process in which blood cells are made. Right, so hemato is blood, poiesis is the production of, All right, so hematopoiesis is just a formation of blood cells from stem cells. These are precursor cells that can develop into other kinds of cells in your body, like red blood cells or white blood cells. We find this in bone marrow. And how many kinds of bone marrow are you familiar with? I think in anatomy we talked about two. There's yellow and red, and yellow bone marrow is what? It's just adipose connective tissue, but red bone marrow is what we call a hematopoietic tissue. It actually can make cells, right? And sometimes we call that a myeloid tissue as well. If it can make all different kinds of blood cells, then it's a myeloid tissue. Okay, so marrow produces about 500 billion cells every day because red blood cells just don't last very long. Okay, and this happens in the fetus, in the liver. All right, so hematopoiesis is the making of blood cells. Erythropoiesis, in particular, is the production or formation of, what did we say erythro meant? Red, right? Red blood cells. All right, so erythropoiesis is that process of making red blood cells. There is a hormone that comes from the kidney when oxygen decreases in the blood. And what's carrying oxygen in the blood once again? I forgot. Oh, yeah, hemoglobin, right? Okay, and so when there are fewer red blood cells, there's less hemoglobin, and that means there's less oxygen in the blood. Your kidney can monitor that, and it secretes a hormone, and that hormone is erythropoietin. So typically, we don't think of the kidney as being an endocrine gland, but here is an example of why you could consider it an important endocrine gland. All right, so it secretes erythropoietin, and it goes to a particular target cell to increase red blood cell production. All right, so what kind of tissue does erythropoietin travel to, or what's the tissue?
Myeloid.
Yeah, myeloid tissue, red bone marrow. And so, what does red bone marrow have? Okay, it has stem cells, but it can observe and react to this signal. It can observe and react to erythropoietin. So what does red bone marrow have to have? It has to have a receptor, right, for erythropoietin. Years ago, the only place where we could get erythropoietin was from donor animals. All right, we maybe have to grind up kidneys and then figure out a way to get erythropoietin out of them. But because of genetic engineering, that gene was transplanted into bacteria, and then bacteria, of course, under the right conditions, can grow like crazy in a test tube. And if they have that gene for erythropoietin, they secrete it outside right into the test tube, and that genetically made through, or that erythropoietin made by genetic engineering, is called EPO, which is commonly what you hear in a hospital. Right, so when you hear EPO, you should really be thinking about erythropoietin, but realize that it's a really handy form. Right, it's produced by, it's still a human protein, but it's made by bacteria for us. Okay, leukopoiesis, guess what that is? Yeah, leuko means white. It's the formation of white blood cells. It's not stimulated by erythropoietin, but by various kinds of cytokines. And these are signaling compounds that are produced by different aspects of your immune system. All right, so these are autocrine regulators secreted by various parts of your lymphatic system and other parts of the immune system. So we don't have time to really go into that too much. All right, so here is just something that we talked about already. Here is a nice response loop that shows how erythropoietin works. Okay, with low oxygen in the blood, the kidney secretes erythropoietin, and since that's a hormone, gets picked up by a capillary into the bloodstream, goes everywhere, in particular red bone marrow. That stimulates the production of red blood cells with hemoglobin inside of it, so now the blood can carry more oxygen. So what kind of loop is this? Because the response counteracts what the stimulus was, and so that's a nice negative feedback loop, which maintains red blood cell homeostasis in the body. This is probably an important exam figure. Okay, what is not in your book, which is, I think, something I would like for you to know, is when all those red blood cells die, what happens to all those important components that are left? So what did we say was inside the cell?
Hemoglobin.
Okay, so let's start with hemoglobin. And let's see what some of the building blocks of hemoglobin are. So we got hemoglobin. We kind of looked at globins already. Does anybody remember globins? Where did we talk about globins? Globulins. Yeah, they're just proteins that we find in blood. So that's the protein part of this molecule, right? So that's a protein part. And the heme part is something a little bit different. The heme part, when hemoglobin is broken down, the globin part is converted into, what's the building block of protein? Yeah, amino acids. And what can your body do with amino acids? Acids, ooh, secrete them out of your body, right? Get rid of them? Amino acids, what would you do with amino acids? You would, make other proteins with them, right? So you would recombine them into the proteins that your body needs. So they're important. You wouldn't waste amino acids. They can also be metabolized for energy. The heme part, can be broken down, or of this hemoglobin molecule, can be broken down into iron, right? So that's just an element, and heme, which is a big biological molecule. It's a big organic molecule, but it's also important biologically. Do you have a hard time making heme? They certainly can't make any iron. The iron can be recycled in people's bodies to make more hemoglobin, and heme pretty much is excreted from the body. Heme is excreted as, all right, first it gets converted into biliverdin, and then biliverdin is converted into bilirubin. Okay, and bilirubin is a component of bile. And so it's eliminated from your body because it's secreted in bile. Okay, and this compound for newborns, and if anybody that has a developing nervous system, is fairly toxic. All right, so this process of breaking down hemoglobin in us is not terribly too bad, unless it happens in very high pathological rates. Right, bilirubin, does anybody know what color bilirubin is? It is a yellow color. Okay, yeah, viridin is probably green. Rubin is yellow. And that can build up in the superficial spots on people's bodies, like their skin and the sclera of their eyes, and it turns their white eyes yellow. What do we call that condition? I don't think we talked about it, but in anatomy. Yeah, that's jaundice. All right, so jaundice could be due to what? Too much destruction of red blood cells, or maybe because the liver helps recycle this compound, it could be due to liver damage, right? If the liver's not functioning, somebody could be jaundiced as well. Okay, and of course that iron could be recycled, okay, to make more hemoglobin. All right, so make sure you can break hemoglobin down into those components. Iron typically is not very toxic, but, and especially for females in their reproductive years, is not very toxic because they lose so much iron every month. But males, it can be certainly accumulate to toxic levels much more rapidly. Okay, so we said that one of the functions of blood is to prevent blood loss and to protect itself. Okay, so we're going to talk about blood groups. And here is part of your immune system. And we're going to talk about a process that we call agglutination. Okay, agglutination is an antigen-antibody reaction. And this can happen between different people if there is a transfusion of blood. Okay, it causes a transfusion reaction. All right, so let's see if I can get away without drawing this on the board. All right, where are antigens located? On the cell membrane. That goes back to almost like the first chapter. All right, so I'm going to just draw a little bit of something right here. Okay, and somebody was doing some experiments, and they got blood to clump, and they did some isolation of proteins that were on the membrane, and they were able to isolate that particular antigen, right? So antigens are sticking off the cell membrane. They're not inside the cell. Antigens are not floating around in the blood. They're attached to the cell. So somebody said, okay, well, this is the first antigen we found, so we're going to call that A for number one, right? Okay, so here is antigen A, but they also found in the person's blood antibodies. And the antibodies that they found are called anti-B. Okay, and I'm going to draw what anti-B looks like. Anti-B doesn't grab onto this A antigen because it doesn't have the right shape. What's the shape that anti-B will grab onto? It's going to have a B shape. Okay, it's not really like a B or an A, but it's going to have some kind of characteristic shape. All right, so then we have, they kept isolating proteins, and they found red blood cells that have what kind of antigen? A B antigen, okay? And guess what? This anti-B antibody can bind to the B antigen on these red blood cells, and when it does, it causes clumping of red blood cells. All right, so you can't put somebody with blood type A. I was going to tell you, actually show you this in a second. All right, so let's talk about that right now. So we got four different blood types. Okay, there is AB, and then somebody found some red blood cells that have both antigens on them, like this, both A and B. And then they found some red blood cells that then didn't have any A or B antigens on the cell surface. All right, so the way that we classify this blood group is by the antigen that's on the cell membrane. So this cell has A antigens on the cell membrane, so what kind of blood type is that? Yeah, that's type A. And so here is type B, and where is the antigen located for blood type B? For blood type B, where is the antigen located? Cell membrane, just like blood type A. All right, and so over here, then here we have blood type, blood type AB. All right, but here was something really confusing. Here's a cell that didn't have any antigens on it at all. So what are you going to call this thing? Okay, so they're thinking, well, we could call it Z, but that really didn't make a lot of sense. And then somebody said, oh, I have an idea. Let's call it zero. But zero looks like an O, so let's just call this blood type O because it doesn't have any antigens on the cell surface. All right, so that is type O. Here's type O. All right, and without any kind of extra work or pre-sensitization, blood type A, a person makes anti-B automatically. And this is this anti-B, this antibody, is going to be in plasma. All right, so here let's put plasma, and over here for antigens we're going to put what? Cell membrane. Okay, and similarly, somebody with blood type B, it automatically makes some antibodies, okay, but not against B cells because they would agglutinate their own blood cells, but against A. Right, so this person produces anti-A. And what about a blood type AB? What kind of antibodies do they automatically produce? It has to be neither of them, right? Because if they produce an antibody to B or A, these cells are going to clump together, right? So these are none, all right? But now we got type O, and a type O automatically produces both anti-A and B. Okay, so I think if you draw that out a couple times, it will make really good sense, which is what we just see on this diagram right here. Okay, so what does anti-A look like? Right, anti-A, the antibody, always has this kind of shape. It's got some, kind of looks like a little guy right here, so I'm going to get rid of this anti-A. And then there are some binding sites. And guess what the shape of this binding site is? Looks like that. So can that bind a B? Does it have the right shape?
Or?
Oh, this is even better. Here. Or does it bind an A? That A can fit right into here, right, from one cell. Another cell next to it that has an A antigen can fit over here, and now those two cells are bound together, right? And that can happen millions and millions of times over, and blood is going to what we clump together, and that process we call agglutination. All right, so an anti-B, what does an anti-B antibody look like? So here, it's going to have two arms like this. Here are the receptor sites, and it's going to look something like that. Okay, that's an anti-B antibody. Here's an anti-A antibody. All right, so on a test, for sure, I'll probably give you a red blood cell, and you got to tell me what blood type it is. Okay, so how about if we just do that really fast? What is... Oh, no, I'm going to do that after we talk about Rh. All right, so the ABO system is one system. You have a couple of nice slides in here. This is just what we did on the board. Here's an antibody. Where do you find antibodies once again? In plasma, right? And here are antigens. Antigens have a specific shape, and you find those on plasma membranes. And if the shapes match up, then that process is what we call agglutination, and that can happen in transfusion reactions. And certainly it can be deadly. What else did I want to say about that? Okay, so here's what agglutination looks like. There are some blood types that can be considered universal donors and universal recipients. Blood type O is what we call the universal donor because why? When we transfuse O into somebody's body, okay, these anti-A and anti-Bs get diluted in a person's blood, but that person has might have anti-A or anti-B, but they can't bind to the cell over here because it has no antigens, right? So if we put this into somebody else's body, it doesn't cause agglutination because why? There are no antigens on the cell surface. So it will live a nice, happy life for about 120 days. Okay, AB is what we call the universal recipient. Where's AB? Right there. Because it's a recipient because it doesn't have any antibodies. So it can receive blood that has no antibodies or B or A because it doesn't have any antibodies for it. All right, so this would be a rare circumstance that you would get somebody's blood that isn't a complete match because the ABO system is just one system for protecting your blood. Here is another system, and this is what we call the Rh system. Rh because this system was worked out on an experimental animal model, which was a rhesus monkey. Okay, so they got some blood from rhesus monkeys. And we have this factor as well, so we're sort of related to rhesus monkeys. And you either have the antigen on the cell surface or you don't. If you have the antigen on red blood cell surface, you're Rh positive. But if you don't have that antigen, then you're Rh negative. All right, so that antigen is going to look like, what is that antigen going to look like? Well, let's just do this. Rh, that's a different shape than A, that's a different shape than B, right? Rh like that. So, what will you get on the test? You'll get a cell. So here is a cell. So what would you call this blood type? Well, A for sure, but what else?
Positive.
Yeah, so here is A positive. Okay. And what about this cell here? How would you blood type that one? It's O because there's no antigens. There's no Rh factor on it, so it is what? O negative. All right, so make sure you can identify cells depending on what kind of antigens on the surface. Yeah.
Which one is the
I really don't know.
Is it
yeah, I don't know. I would have to Google it. I don't have it in my memory to tell you which the... I shouldn't say, because I'm not certain. Okay, so transfusion reactions cause destruction of red blood cells and release of hemoglobin into the blood, right? And that's taken care of by the liver, produces a lot of bilirubin, and somebody can become jaundiced. Okay, here is something else. We said that a person is born with antibody, anti-B, anti-A in their blood, but for the Rh factor, you're not automatically born with anti-Rh factor. So if you're Rh negative, right, you can have anti-Rh in your blood and it's not going to agglutinate on your cells because there's no Rh antigen on cells. But this can cause problems. For instance, if the mother is Rh negative and the fetus is Rh positive. So if the fetus has Rh positive blood, what's something special about their red blood cells compared to the mom? What does the fetus have that the mom doesn't have? It has, yeah, the fetus has Rh antigens on the cell membrane. So it has antigens. And don't forget, the fetus is inside the mom, but their circulations are pretty much separated from each other. They come into close contact via the placenta, right? But they're really not in contact with each other. So usually a first pregnancy goes normally because there are no Rh antibodies in the mom's blood. Because that doesn't happen automatically. She has to be sensitized to that antigen. Then her body will recognize it as being foreign and then build antibodies, okay, to protect herself from it. And of course, that seems really strange because, right, since we want this baby, this fetus to be born, that is not a good thing. Okay, but at the first pregnancy, right, during birth, there is a lot of mixing of fetal blood and maternal blood, and enough for the mother to become sensitized to that Rh antigen on the cell surface. All right, so the second and third pregnancies, we have to worry about agglutination because the mom is what? Rh negative. She can make anti-Rh because she was exposed during that first pregnancy. She makes a lot of anti-Rh antibodies, and those can get into the fetus, and that antibody then can bind to the Rh antigens of the fetus and cause what in the fetus? Yeah, agglutination, right? So that antibody can grab the fetus's red blood cells, join them together, and cause agglutination, which leads to lysis and the release of hemoglobin from those cells, okay, which does what to that individual? What builds up inside their body if there's a lot of red blood cell destruction? A lot of bilirubin builds up, right? Because that's a breakdown product of hemoglobin, and then that baby is born jaundiced. And that's always one thing that we look for when somebody is born. It goes into their Apgar score. And in a developing individual, that bilirubin is very toxic to their nervous system. So we really would like to pay attention to this. And before you could get a marriage license years ago, you would always have to get a blood test to find out, okay, if the mom was Rh negative. So how could it be that the mom is Rh negative but has an Rh positive baby? Because dad is Rh positive, right? Okay, so that's where that trait came from. Okay, so that condition where there is destruction of fetal red blood cells, we call that erythroblastosis fetalis, or hemolytic disease of the newborn, same thing. All right, and that happens because the anti-Rh antibodies are relatively small compared to the anti-A and anti-B. You've never heard of erythroblastosis fetalis due to the ABO system because anti-A and anti-B are big antibodies. They can't go from the mom's blood into fetal blood because they can't cross the placenta. Unlike the anti-Rh antibody, it can cross the placenta and get into the fetus. Okay. All right, so what are we all worried about? Well, we're worried about blood loss because blood is a fluid connective tissue, and when there's a hole in a blood vessel, it's just going to run right out. All right, so we're interested in hemostasis. Hemostasis is just the prevention of bleeding when a blood vessel is damaged. And we got to know about two different forms of hemostasis in your body. There's platelet plug formation, and this works really good for microscopic tears in blood vessels, very small tears, all right, but still big enough for plasma and red blood cells to leak out. And the second one is called fibrin formation. Fibrin formation is also called coagulation. Okay, and this is used for large tears in blood vessels. All right, so here is coagulation. Coagulation is important for preventing blood loss. And what it does, coagulation produces a compound that we call fibrin. All right, so coagulation is fibrin formation. That's pretty much the definition. And fibrin is a protein, and you have a bunch of it in your blood, but it doesn't automatically produce blood clots because what form is fibrin in right now? You have billions of molecules of it, but it's not causing a blood clot because it's in what kind of form? An ogen form, right? It's in fibrinogen, which means it's inactive. It has to be activated. Okay, so coagulation is fibrin formation, but what about agglutination? Agglutination is a different process. How are you going to think about agglutination? It is an antigen-antibody reaction. All right, so agglutination is an antigen-antibody reaction, but coagulation is what? Fibrin formation. Two totally different processes, but they kind of look similar. Right? You kind of think of them similarly because they cause red blood cells to clump together. Okay? The only difference is that coagulation also produces this fibrin, which works as a net that catches all kinds of compounds as blood is leaving a blood vessel. All right, so let's talk about this first one first, platelet plug formation for microscopic tears. So here we have a blood vessel, and I know it's a blood vessel because I see a bunch of red blood cells in there, and I would guess it's probably colored red. Is it colored red for you guys? Oh, how nice. Okay, so here we have the lumen of a blood vessel, and I know this is a blood vessel because here I can see the endothelium. These are, what, it's just a nice simple squamous epithelium lining this blood vessel, and I don't see any damage to these cells. All right, so they're protecting the blood tissue from underlying things that that are in the basement membrane of this epithelium, namely collagen fibers. So we have collagen fibers. Oh, yeah, collagen fibers right in here. We also have another component bound to these collagen fibers, which is called Van Willebrand's factor. We'll see what that does in just a second. And there are also some special enzymes that are added to the surface of the endothelium, and we're just going to call that CD39 because there was what? CD1, CD2, and this is the one we're interested. We had to go all the way to 39 to get it. And what 39 does is that it takes an ADP, dephosphorylates it, right, and turns it into AMP. Not a cyclic AMP, but just a regular old AMP. So CD39 is what class of enzymes? It is a... What takes phosphorus off of something? It's a phosphatase, right? So it's a phosphatase that dephosphorylates ADP. Because we're going to see ADP has a special signaling component to it. Okay. Ah, all right. So I call these things red blood cells, but we're talking about platelets right here. So even though they look like red blood cells, let's consider these things platelets, right, which are small cell fragments. So make sure you see these things not as red blood cells, but as platelets. Okay, when the cell is normal, it's going to secrete some compounds, namely nitric oxide and prostacyclin, right? And it keeps these platelets from becoming active, right? So they keep clots from forming, and they also, nitric oxide and PGI2 are vasodilators, right? And when a vessel vasodilates, that means a lot of blood can flow through it. We'll see how that is in the next chapter. All right, so this is under normal circumstances. ADP is kept low, and NO is kept high, as well as PGI2 is kept high at high concentrations in the blood. And that prevents activation of these platelets, right? So now they are inactive because there's no ADP and there's a lot of these other chemicals. All right, so if we damage this blood vessel, what happens? This endothelial cell gets ripped open or maybe ripped apart or who knows what happens to it, okay? Cut in half, smashed completely, and then blood can come into contact with the collagen layers underneath the endothelium. All right. So here we have a damaged endothelial cell. When it's damaged, right, then it can't dephosphorylate ADP, can't secrete nitric oxide, can't secrete PGI2, which is what keeps the blood vessel normal. So instead, all right, these platelets can bind to that von Willebrand factor. Also, when it comes into contact with collagen, right, it's going to secrete a lot of ATP, ADP, and also TXA2. That's a thromboxane A2. And also serotonin, not shown on this slide. It releases serotonin. So what are the functions of these things? All right, serotonin causes more platelets to bind together, and so does ADP, and both of them also cause vasoconstriction. And when a blood vessel vasoconstricts, that prevents or that reduces the amount of blood flow into that vessel, which then reduces the amount of blood loss through this disruption in the endothelium. All right, so this is what we call the platelet release reaction. Right, when collagen is exposed to plasma, right, and these platelets, they become activated. Right, because they bind to collagen, they bind to von Willebrand factor, and they start secreting lots of ADP and serotonin. Oh, and here's an interesting thing. Aspirin. Y'all probably know that aspirin is what we call a blood thinner, but you're going to see that that's really a misnomer, because when you take aspirin, your blood does not get any thinner. Right? It disrupts clotting function. And it disrupts clotting function because aspirin blocks the synthesis of prostaglandins like taxa A2. Right? Thus, it blocks the platelet release reaction, which is maybe one of the initial steps in coagulation. Right? So aspirin blocks the production of all different kinds of prostaglandins, not just the one that initiates blood clotting, or which is important for the platelet plug formation. Okay, so serotonin, thromboxane stimulate vasoconstriction, reducing blood flow. ADP and taxa A2 cause other platelets to become sticky and attach to collagen fibers. All right, so if this is like at a microscopic level, then here is a platelet plug, and blood can't leak out of this particular blood vessel. All right, so this is a platelet plug formation. Now, did I say anything about fibrin formation in platelet plug formation? I did not. And that's because that's the second kind of process that we're interested in, right? So platelet plug is for small tears, does not include fibrin formation, but now we got to talk about fibrin formation, the second kind. All right, so fibrin formation. All right, there's a large rip in a blood vessel. Okay, the platelet plug still forms, but then it becomes all woven together with a meshwork of fibrin. And that meshwork of fibrin is what we call a blood clot. And it contains platelets and fibrin and also trapped red blood cells that try to leak out of that blood vessel. And the platelet then undergoes plug contraction to form a complete plug over that damaged blood vessel. All right, so I don't think I want to read this to you. I want to go right to a slide. All right, so this looks kind of complicated, but we're going to break it down. So this is what we call coagulation. All right, here's the process of coagulation in your blood. Is that the same thing as an antibody-antigen reaction? What do we call that antibody-antigen reaction? Agglutination. And that is just the binding of an antibody to an antigen. All right, and I don't see any antigens or antibodies in this scheme at all. It's just a number of different compounds and enzymes that become activated. Okay, so I see two pathways that can lead to coagulation. Some of these pathways overlap and feed into the production of fibrin from what compound? Fibrinogen, right? Fibrinogen is an inactive compound. It gets converted to fibrin, which then forms that blood clot, which is what we call coagulation. But there are some steps before that that have to occur. Okay, so this extrinsic pathway is what normally happens in your body. Right, and that means what? Tissue damage, which then the blood comes in contact with collagen. Then there is something called thromboplastin activator, which activates this compound. This is an enzyme, and what can that do? Does it get used up in this reaction? It doesn't. So that's a level of amplification right here, right? So when you have damage to a blood vessel, you would like to close it off fast, right? So here is one way that that can happen, because here is a level of amplification. All right, so if you have this factor activated along with some other things, and this is, I think, important for you to know. This is an exam figure. This is one of the things that's whited out, okay? Because in order to get coagulation happening, you need calcium. Okay, so what else do you need calcium for? Strong bones, what else? Muscle contraction, synaptic transmission, okay, but also calcium. Without the proper levels of calcium in your blood, you would bleed to death relatively fast, right, just from small injuries to your body, right? So coagulation is another important function for calcium. And then also phospholipids, free phospholipids in the blood. And where do these phospholipids come from? That's the cell membrane, right? Whenever there's cellular damage, that releases phospholipids. So these are important accelerators for coagulation. So when this factor is activated and these compounds are in the blood, then clotting factor 10 can be activated. Okay, so we're just going to call that factor 10. And it becomes activated by this enzyme. All right, so what is this? This is another level of amplification, because that enzyme doesn't get used up. That enzyme can work on prothrombin. Prothrombin is kind of similar, all right, to something that we looked at already, but it's not because of a suffix that I'm looking at. It's because of a prefix that I see right here. Most times in biology, when you see a word with a PRO as a prefix, that also means an inactive form, right? But it can be converted into an active form very quickly, okay? And it's converted into an active form by what? An activated factor 10. And we call that prothrombin activator. So an activated factor 10 is what we call prothrombin activator, because what does it do? It activates prothrombin, converting it into thrombin. So this step right here is prothrombin activator formation. And again, what do you need? Phospholipids and calcium in order to make thrombin. And thrombin is another enzyme. And thrombin then can bump into fibrinogen and convert it into fibrin. So what is this? Does that thrombin get used up every time it converts a fibrinogen into fibrin? No, it's an enzyme, right? It doesn't get depleted. And so here is another step of amplification. And so that makes what? Fibrin formation a relatively rapid kind of process. All right, and what are some important compounds that you need? Calcium and phospholipids in order to make fibrin right here. All right, but here, this figure is not exactly the one that you have in your book. Okay? Because it doesn't talk, your book does talk about the intrinsic pathway a little bit, but it doesn't show you an important feedback mechanism. So here we have a cascade, right, with different levels of amplification, right? This normally doesn't happen, but if you put blood in a test tube, for instance, then it will happen. But part of it will happen normally inside your body. Okay, because here is factor 11 that's activated, and that can activate factor 9, and then factor 9 comes back over here, and it can activate prothrombin activator. And if prothrombin activator is active, what happens? It produces thrombin, okay? And look at this arrow right here. Thrombin not only can convert fibrinogen to fibrin, but thrombin can also activate factor 11. All right, then what does 11 do? 11 makes more thrombin. If there's more thrombin, it can make more activated factor 11, which does what? Makes more thrombin. So here is a positive feedback mechanism in this process we call coagulation, which again makes this process very rapid. Okay, and there's a difference. So here is a level of amplification, and it's a cascade level of amplification, so it's a very fast mechanism. All right, heparin blocks the ability of thrombin to activate number 11, right? So all of these compounds are still in your body, so nothing gets thinned in blood. What does heparin do? It disrupts this coagulation pathway. It doesn't really thin the blood, but for most people, right, that's a little bit too complicated to think about. All right, so heparin therapy is a anticoagulation therapy for people that are generating blood clots that we don't want them to generate. Okay, but it's not because their blood gets any thinner. They still have the same amount of red blood cells, the same amount of white blood cells, right? The same amount of proteins. It's just that this pathway, right, is blocked because what part of coagulation is blocked with heparin? This positive feedback loop, right? This simple positive feedback loop is blocked, and then somebody is going to have reduced clotting function as a result of that. So here's a positive feedback mechanism that's very important for maintaining what? Hemostasis, right? Which is just another form of what? Homeostasis. Okay, patients with hemophilia have no factor 8. Where's factor 8? Here's factor 8 right here. So patients with hemophilia also have reduced blood clotting function because this positive feedback mechanism can't occur in them. And hemophiliacs, of course, even with a small paper cut, they could bleed to death, okay, because they have very, very little clotting function. All right, so those are some of the things that I want you to see on this diagram, that really there are basically only three things. All right, there's prothrombin activator formation here, there's thrombin formation here, and then there is finally fibrin formation. And that fibrinogen is soluble in water, right? But fibrin is not. It precipitates out. It's a protein, but it precipitates out in such a way that it forms a network. Okay, this table right here is included, but you don't have to really memorize much about this, except what? You see the importance of calcium ions right here. Okay, and you should also know that prothrombin, what kind of molecule is prothrombin? Inactive, right? But you have a sufficient store in your body to where it can be activated to physiologic levels very quickly. By what? Prothrombin activator. And what can you tell me about fibrinogen? It's inactive as well. It's soluble, but there's enough in your blood, and it can be activated very quickly and converted into fibrin, which is going to prevent blood loss. And fibrinogen is converted into fibrin by thrombin. That's one of the important steps. Okay. And this is what fibrin looks like. Here we see some red blood cells, so these are not platelets like on that other diagram. These are truly red blood cells, and they are all clumped together, not because of an antigen-antibody reaction, but because of what? Coagulation is the formation of what? The formation of fibrin, right? So fibrin formation is coagulation. It's not an antibody-antigen reaction. Okay. So you might be wondering, gee whiz, what happens with that positive feedback mechanism? How come your whole body doesn't just turn into a big blood clot? And what would happen if all your blood clotted all at one time? Well, that would be fatal, right? Because then it wouldn't transport oxygen or anything around in your body. So there are ways that your body has to dissolve blood clots after the tissue heals, and also to maintain a clot in the area where it should be and to prevent clots from forming in areas where it should not be. For instance, if you get a paper cut on your right index finger, would it be good for coagulation to take place in your left leg or your right leg or anywhere in your brain? Absolutely not, right? It should just be where that injury is. Right, so there are things that limit that coagulation. Some patients, unfortunately, lose that ability, and they do form blood clots throughout their whole vascular system. And that's really sad when that happens. It's really hard to manage, and usually not managed very successfully. All right, so let's look at some things that can limit fibrin formation. All right, so when the damage is repaired, there's an activated factor 12 that causes the production of kallikrein, or activation of kallikrein. Kallikrein converts plasminogen. What can you tell me about plasminogen? And this plasminogen, I think I want you to know something about. Kallikrein, I don't think I'm too interested in. But I'm interested that you know something about plasminogen. It's inactive, but it can be converted into an active form very rapidly, right, by this kallikrein molecule. So it gets converted to plasmin. And plasmin is an enzyme, and it can break down fibrin, and it dissolves a clot. All right, so that's a really handy factor. There is another compound called tissue plasminogen activator, or TPA. Right? TPA can be given to people to produce plasmin, and that plasmin then is going to dissolve blood clots. So could you think of a reason, maybe why, you would like to dissolve a blood clot in somebody? Yeah, stroke. Okay, but what kind of stroke? We can have a couple different kinds of stroke. That's why this is fun to think about. Okay, so for instance, you could get a stroke, which is what? Reduced blood flow to your brain. If a blood vessel blows up, right, then whatever is distal to that place where the blood vessel is damaged doesn't get any blood. Right, so if there is an aneurysm and it ruptures, right, then you have blood leaking out into the brain. Now, would you like to reduce clotting function in somebody that has a bursted blood vessel? No. Okay. But for instance, maybe a person's heart is generating blood clots and it goes to the brain and it produces a stroke because it's blocking a blood vessel, bringing oxygen to the brain. Would you like to be able to remove that blood clot? Absolutely, and plasmin can do that. Right. But of course, you have to be pretty sophisticated to know what kind of patient you're dealing with, what kind of stroke they're having. Right. So a number of hospitals here in Los Angeles certainly are sophisticated enough, like Long Beach Memorial certainly is. If you get somebody with a stroke quick enough to the emergency room and it can be diagnosed as a blood clot to the brain, it can be reduced, right? It can be reversed with giving that patient tissue plasminogen activator. And plasminogen makes plasmin, and that will dissolve the blood clot. But certainly don't ever want to give that medication to somebody that is bleeding in the brain, because why? What will make it? It will make it worse, right? Okay. All right, so that's why it's important to know what you're doing. So that's why it's important to know about plasminogen and plasmin, because you'll probably run into that sometime. All right, some things can be used as anticoagulants. Calcium chelators, like EDTA, when it's introduced into blood, it takes calcium out of solution. It just grabs calcium. We call that a chelator, and it prevents the blood from clotting. Certainly, we don't want to do that in a person, right, because it's going to chelate calcium all over your body, and what else do you need calcium for? Synaptic transmission, muscle contraction, et cetera, et cetera. We don't want to inhibit or stop any of those processes. But, for instance, when somebody is donating blood or a blood sample is taken from you and we want to keep it as a fluid in that test tube, then it's very nice to have EDTA in that test tube to keep it from clotting, right, because it removes calcium. We looked at heparin, okay, because it blocks thrombin formation. Right? And coumarin is another anticoagulant. It blocks clotting by inhibiting the activation of vitamin K. And vitamin K is indirectly involved with calcium levels in the blood. Okay, so if you increase vitamin K in your diet, you increase clotting function. If you decrease vitamin K in your diet, you decrease clotting function. Right? And it works pretty quickly. So when somebody is on coumarin therapy, they have to maintain pretty much a constant diet, because that's where we get vitamin K from, right? Your body can't make vitamin K since it's a vitamin. It's an essential nutrient. Somebody on this kind of therapy has to get their coumarin levels measured early on, okay, to make sure that it's therapeutic, because if there's too much, what will happen? If we're giving coumarin to somebody and we give them too much, what's going to happen? Well, it won't coagulate, right? They could bleed to death. So they have to have the proper levels, right? So their diet has to be pretty much constant in terms of vitamin K ingestion, and then coumarin levels can be adjusted as after that. All right, so what kind of foods have a lot of vitamin K? Anybody know? I only ask because I do know the answer to that question. It's green leafy vegetables, right? And I suppose it doesn't have to be really leafy, because broccoli is a really good source of vitamin K. Okay, and that sort of reminds me of my nephews when they were really, really young. Okay, they were probably 3, 4, and 5, or 2, 4, and 5, and they would roughhouse around, and eventually somebody would end up falling into the coffee table or something and getting a bloody nose. Okay, and then they would come over to Uncle Joel for comfort, and I would comfort them a little bit, but then I would describe to them, okay, this pathway right here. right? And I would say, well, your extrinsic pathway isn't working with the intrinsic pathway because this factor wasn't being produced and that factor wasn't produced, okay? And the bottom line was, okay, they would never eat broccoli as kids or any kind of green leafy substance, right? So they had no vitamin K, so their blood clotting function was reduced. So for sure, whenever they injured their body, it would have a tendency to bleed, right? So even though I explained this to them maybe 100 times, they would still never eat broccoli, would never get vitamin K in their diet. They would rather bleed to death than eat broccoli. It always amazed me. Okay. All right, pulmonary and systemic circulations. You got to know this on your own. I don't want to take time to go over that, but we can sort of review this really quickly. So we have a heart. How many hearts do you have? You got one, yeah? Okay, that's sort of true. Okay, how many valves does a heart have?
Four.
Yeah, you should just yell that out. If you don't know the number of valves and where they're located, then you got to go back and review that. So you got one heart, sort of, four valves. How many chambers?
Four
chambers, the same as the number of valves, right? So it's four valves, four chambers. If you can't yell that out right away, you got to go back and look at that. Okay. But now, how many sides to the heart do you have? For instance, how many ventricles do you have? You've got two. So you've got two sides to the heart. You got a right and a left. And because you have two sides to the heart, guess what? How many circulations do you have? You got two. You got pulmonary and systemic circulation. So really, you don't have one heart, you have two hearts, but they're joined together with the interventricular septum, right? One part of the heart pumps blood through the pulmonary circulation and the other side pumps through the systemic circulation. So you actually have two pumps, but they work together very, very nicely. Okay, so you also should know the definition of an artery and a vein, okay? So for instance, here I see a blood vessel red, which signifies that it is high in oxygen. It's high in oxygen. So this red blood vessel right here, is this a vein or an artery? Okay, and you should see that as being a vein. And you might be wondering, well, how on earth could that be a vein but still be high in oxygen? And that's because it's part of the pulmonary circulation, and pulmonary circulation is what? Opposite compared to the systemic circulation. So we're very familiar with the systemic circulation where arteries contain relatively oxygenated blood and veins do not. Okay, and also on this diagram, one thing that you can see all the valves real nice here too in parts of the heart. So you should label this heart and all of these blood vessels. And I see a really nice functional part of the vascular system that allows for exchange. And what is that? And those are capillaries, right? So things can only enter or leave the blood through a capillary, and you should have a nice picture in your mind why that is, and that's because, what, the number of layers. Capillaries only have a simple squamous epithelium, only an endothelium, but veins and arteries have all these different layers of elastic tissue, muscle tissue, which then inhibits diffusion, because this happens by diffusion. Okay. So I think that's all I'm going to say about this stuff, but you could ask me some questions about this in a little bit. One thing I do want to say, okay, oh, this is pretty important. Okay, so here we have two pumps back to back. How about the amount of blood that's pumped by the right ventricle compared to the amount of blood pumped by the left ventricle? Should they be the same or could it be different? Okay. Well, if it's different, if, say, the left ventricle is pumping more blood than the right ventricle, where is that blood going to go? Well, but it goes, if the left ventricle is pumping blood, okay, then the rest of the body has to hold on to that blood, and your body is going to swell up. What about if the right ventricle is pumping more blood than the left? Where is it going to go? It's going to build up in the lungs, right, and that's going to cause, like, a pneumonia condition. All right, so really what I want to tell you is that the right ventricle and left ventricle have to pump the same amount of blood, right? Maybe not every microsecond or millisecond, but over a relatively short time period, they have to keep up with each other, okay? So they have to pump the same amount of blood. So the rate of flow through the systemic circulation must equal the rate of flow through the pulmonary circulation. Otherwise, blood is going to build up in one or the other, and we don't want that to happen, okay? So both ventricles pump the same amount of blood. But we're going to see that the pulmonary circulation is very small. The systemic circulation, of course, is very, very big. The blood vessels are short for the pulmonary circulation. Blood vessels for the systemic circulation are very long. And as a result, the systemic circulation has a very high resistance, right? The resistance in the pulmonary circulation is very low. So how is it that we can maintain blood flow through these different circulations, keep them the same, if their resistance changes? So here is an equation that you should just, I guess, memorize, and that is blood flow, the flow through a blood vessel, what is that equal to? And blood flow, or the flow of any kind of fluid, whether it's a gas, which we're going to look at in a little bit, or a fluid, will always go from high pressure to low pressure. What does that remind you of? Yeah, like diffusion, for instance. Diffusion always works. Things will move from high concentration to low concentration. This fluid in these blood vessels will only flow from high pressure to low pressure, right? So what is that? So here we have pressure. In order to get blood flow, you got to have pressure, right? High pressure, say, in an artery, low pressure in a vein. But there's something that impedes the flow of blood, and that is resistance. All right, so blood flow is equal to pressure divided by resistance. So I'm going to talk about these terms just a second. What's the relationship between blood flow and pressure? Okay, if pressure goes up, what happens to blood flow? It goes up as well. We call that directly related. Okay, if pressure increases, blood flow increases because it's directly related. Pressure is in the numerator in this equation. All right, let's consider resistance right here. Is resistance in the numerator? No, it's where? Who knows that? Yeah, it's in a denominator. So a little math helps and algebra helps. All right, so what's the relationship between resistance and blood flow here? Guess what? We don't want to say directly related. We want to say not indirectly, but inversely related. So it's kind of, I kind of tricked you a little bit. It's inversely related. All right? That just means that if one of these variables increases, the other one decreases. So as resistance gets bigger, what happens to blood flow? It slows down because it's inversely related. Okay. So the systemic circulation has a really high resistance. But the blood flow, we said, has to be the same through both the systemic and pulmonary circulation. So if the resistance for the systemic circulation is really high, how can it maintain the same blood flow as the pulmonary circulation? That's right. Okay, we can increase the pressure to the same amount that the resistance is increasing, and if we increase both, what happens to blood flow? It just stays the same. Okay, so if you look at the right ventricle and left ventricle, you see that the left ventricle is very muscular. It's probably over a centimeter thick, but the right ventricle is very, very thin. That just means that the left ventricle has to work a lot harder, right? It has more muscle. And because it has more muscle, it can produce much more pressure. And indeed, the pressure in the left ventricle, okay, varies between 120 millimeters of mercury and 80. The pressure in the right ventricle is probably never even reaches 20 millimeters of mercury. Okay, because it's pumping the same amount of blood, but it's only through the lungs, and the lungs have very low resistance. So the right ventricle really doesn't have to do much at all. Okay, heart valves, certainly you got to know all those things and the pieces of valves and what they're attached to, right, the fibrous skeleton of the heart. Now, this takes us to some physiology, since we reviewed anatomy really quick, all right, and that has to do with the cardiac cycle. All right, cardiac cycle. Your heart is not like an electric pump that's spinning around all the time, pumping blood through your system. Sometimes your heart is pumping blood, and there are other times it's not, because it's a muscle. All right, so that repeated pattern of contraction and relaxation is our important functions of the heart, and we give them different names. Systole refers to the contraction phase of the heart, and diastole refers to the relaxation phase. Okay, and what happens, okay, you know where the atria are. Both atria contract together, and there's a little bit of a delay, and then that's followed by contraction of the ventricles. The atria are the two chambers that are in the basal region of the heart. The ventricles are what, near the apex of the heart. And it's the ventricles that really pump blood through circulations. The atria only pump a little bit of blood into the ventricles. So here we said normal systemic pressure, 120 over 80. Normal pulmonary pressure is hard to measure, right? But it's about 20 over 10, something like that, 20, 25 over 10. And now you kind of know why that is, right? And that's because the resistance of those two circuits is different. Okay. Let's look at some volumes of the heart. So the heart has some chambers, and you can measure the volume of those chambers, and let's measure it in milliliters. We can measure it at the end of diastole. What the heck is diastole again? What is diastole? Okay, diastole is when the heart is relaxed. Okay, when the heart is relaxed, blood can flow into it, and when blood flows in, the ventricles expand. Okay, so that happens during diastole. And so we can measure end diastolic volume. That's the largest volume that a ventricle can have at end diastole. And then what's it going to do? It's going to contract, what we call contraction phase once again. Systole, that's systole, right? And then at the end of systole, we can measure the amount of blood that's left inside of the ventricle. A ventricle can't pump 100% of the blood out. There's always going to be some little residual volume there. And we can measure it, we call that end systolic volume, right, which is the amount of blood left in the ventricles at the end of systole. All right, and then after systole, what happens? Heart relaxes, starts to fill up with blood again. All right, so sometimes we would like to know how well this heart is functioning. Every time it beats, how much blood is actually being pumped out of the heart, okay? Well, if we know the end diastolic volume and the end systolic volume, we can calculate it just by subtracting the two. And that's the amount of blood that the heart pumps every time it beats. We call that the stroke volume. Okay. So how would you have to use, and we're just going to say EDV for end diastolic volume and ESV for end systolic volume. How can we measure stroke volume knowing EDV and ESV? Yes, EDV minus ESV. Because which one is the big volume? The diastolic volume, because that's when the heart expands. That's when it fills up with blood. Okay. All right, so which is larger? Make sure you know that. And be able to calculate the stroke volume. When somebody's having a failing heart, right, that stroke volume goes way, way down. It hardly pumps any blood. And sometimes the end diastolic volume gets very big. Their heart gets dilated, and it gets weaker as it gets dilated. Okay. So we're going to start looking at cardiac cycle, especially with this diagram right here. And this is not exactly an exam figure, but it's close to the exam figure that I have for you in Blackboard, which used to be in your lab book, but it's not in your lab book anymore. This is what we call a Wiggers diagram. And so you might want to look at that sometime before the next lecture, because I'm going to talk about these things. What are these things? It's a plot of various physiologic parameters versus time. We have volume versus time, okay, and we have pressure versus time, we have electrical activity versus time, and then some sounds that the heart makes versus time, and they're all put together so that they all happen at the correct time with respect to each other, okay. So this point here is the same time as this point here is the same time as this one here is the same time as this one right here. Okay, so that's where we're going to start next time. Sign-in sheet. Oh. Did I pass a sign-in sheet around? I did not. I brought one down. Rats. Okay, well, no sign-in sheet today. So you don't get credit for being in lecture today. Sorry. Okay. Any questions, any comments from our SI leader?
No.
Okay. Have a nice afternoon. Yeah, the chapters for the exam are 13, 14, 16, 17, and 20.
Just saying what you're